But we're all continuing to process last month's Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. Obviously, most of that discussion is about the practical impacts of the ruling, how it affects the law, how it affects women, how it affects doctors and healthcare. But the ruling also opens up new questions about the Supreme Court and how it works in the first place. Michael Gearhart is the Burton Craig Distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence at the UNC School of Law. He's also the author or co-author of numerous books and articles about the court and the Constitution, including Constitutional Theory, Arguments and Perspectives, and the Power of Precedent. And he joins us here now in the studio to begin to scratch the surface on the many things that we can talk about here. Professor Gearhart, thank you so much for being with us today. Good morning.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate being here.
So we can get into 15 different topics related to this, but before we get into specifics, what were and what are your general thoughts about this decision?
Well, my first thought is probably not a unique one for your listeners, and that is that this, we all knew this was coming. And it's not just because there was a leak of the Supreme Court's opinion earlier this year. It's because a number of presidents have promised to put justices on the Supreme Court who would vote to overrule Roe versus Wade. Most recently, President Trump placed three justices with that promise. And therefore, for these justices to vote to overrule Roe was not a surprise. They followed through on one of the major reasons why they are currently on the Supreme Court. I think beyond that, we know that Republicans and particularly conservatives for years have been arranging and working for this moment to happen. It's been no secret. For decades, that for the Republican Party, which has had a platform promising such a thing, that the party is mobilized behind this. There's no issue that mobilizes, I think, Republicans more than changing the courts and particularly arranging for the overruling of Roe versus Wade.
There are a number of things that we know or that we think we know about the Supreme Court that tend to be the case with Supreme Court rulings. They rarely issue big sweeping rulings when more minimalistic rulings are possible. They rarely overturn precedent. Scholars of the Supreme Court have a line that the Supreme Court tends to follow the election returns, even though it's an undemocratic institution. All of those things seem to be out the window now. So to what extent do we have to revisit our general understanding of the Supreme Court as just an institution?
Well, I think it's worth revisiting because I think we've probably been subject to a couple different myths about the Supreme Court for some time. The first is that the court is completely apolitical. Mm. That's just not true. It's never been true. And so to the extent anybody is saying, well, this is kind of a new thing, the politicization of the court and justices, it's not. It's been a factor, it's been a dynamic since George Washington was in office. George Washington appointed only people who would be supporting the national government, who were really strong capital F Federalists, and that meant favoring national power over state power. Subsequent presidents, Abraham Lincoln, appointed justices who would back up his war policies, and also ultimately support Reconstruction. Franklin Roosevelt appointed justices who would support the New Deal, particularly its constitutionality. Again, I've mentioned, and it's true, several presidents have promised to appoint justices who would vote to overrule Roe. So that's been the reality. So the myth that somehow the court is above or beyond politics is just that. It's a myth. I think the second thing we've got to revisit is the extent to which people use the Supreme Court to implement their political agendas. Now, this isn't unique to the justices that overruled Roe versus Wade, but it's worth understanding that Roe versus Wade, decided in 1973, was decided by a Supreme Court that was dominated by Republicans. The decision in Roe versus Wade was 7-2. Every Republican voted in the majority of that opinion of Roe, except for one. So the other thing we're seeing is that the Republican Party itself, particularly Republican judges, are not the same as they used to be. And that's another reality we have to come to terms with. These justices that voted to overturn Roe are not interested in following national election returns. quite frankly, I think they're interested in fulfilling their party's agenda, of which overruling Roe is just one thing.
To what extent is that a difference with the justices today, and to what extent do you think that's a difference with the Republican Party today?
The difference being...
The way the justices behave in 73 versus today.
Well, I think that the justices in 73 were more what we might consider as kind of classic conservatives who would have really respected precedent. In fact, Roe is grounded in precedent. Justice Kavanaugh said as much in his confirmation hearings. And those justices were actually doing what they thought was following precedent in cases like Griswold, which recognized the right to contraception. So these justices, I think, have been appointed in part because they do not, because they've really promised and pledged throughout their lives not to respect precedent. Amy Coney Barrett's entire academic career was based on articles and speeches about how it's important for a justice not to follow precedent, but to actually look to other things like so-called original meaning or text. So these justices, I think, again, have made good on what we expected, made good on their careers. And keep in mind that if President Trump thought these three were going to vote over Roe, just think about, okay, what would he have to know in order to be confident that they would do that? And for the senators like Josh Hawley, who said he would only vote for somebody who would recognize Roe's wrong, what did they know? Well, whatever they knew turns out to be pretty solid knowledge, because the result is what they wanted.
Speaking with Michael Gearhart again, UNC, a law professor, and I mentioned it up top, you're the author of a book called The Power of Precedent. So to what extent does that book have to be revised now?
Well, probably not much, because I did, although that book was published in 2008 and updated not too long thereafter, the book really recognized there were different approaches to precedent, and that there was an approach of the kind I've just mentioned, justices or judges who would really only agree with the precedents they forged, not the precedents that others did that they happen to disagree with. It's been a view, I call it a weak view of precedent, weak also in the sense that the court had not always followed that path. Mm. But what I probably have to do is just simply add to what I'd already written about Roe. I'd talked about how Roe had been reaffirmed more than 30 times. So one thing that's unprecedented here is the overruling of a precedent that had been reaffirmed that many times.
Again, speaking with Michael Gearhart. So one of the things that folks are talking about now with respect to the Supreme Court is just the extent to which its institutional legitimacy is in question or being challenged. This is also something that has happened at different times in the past. So what do you make of the way that discussion is taking place now?
It's a great question. I think it's a really important discussion. Because what does sort of recognizing the court's institutional legitimacy mean? I will have to say, I think right now it's hard. If the court can change its decision-making based on its membership, if it can be reoriented because of changes in its membership, what does that tell us about the rule of law? Now, for some people, that might tell us, oh, the justices that came before didn't believe in the rule of law. But the rule of law doesn't, and it's not supposed to track a party's platform. It's supposed to be grounded in such things as text and precedent, and for some justices, original meaning. This opinion in Dobbs, for example, is not grounded in any of those. It disregards precedent. In fact, Justice Thomas says those precedents on which Roe was based perhaps need revisiting as well. It's not grounded on text, although Justice Kavanaugh declared in oral argument, well, the text says nothing about abortion. That's true because the text speaks in broad terms, not narrow terms. The text talks about due process as it relates to the protection of liberty. And liberty includes certain freedoms, the court has said, for more than a century. Those freedoms include things like a right to marry, a right to contraception, and yes, the court in Roe said a right to terminate a pregnancy within a certain period of time. And so those developments are all well known. I think what we're confronted with in trying to come up with a clarity on what is what's important to the court's legitimacy has to do with the extent to which justices are not voting their personal preferences, not voting just to make the people that appointed them happy. And it's hard to think that after this week, because Dobbs isn't just the only opinion. An opinion which struck down a more than a century-old law in New York that had banned concealed weaponry in public, not a crazy law at all. Actually, it didn't ban it. It just required licensing for it. And the court said, no, that kind of licensing should not have to be required because these weapons could be used for self-defense. I wonder to what extent people riding on the subways in New York are going to think it's really necessary to have an AR-15, among other things, to protect them on the subway. Shootings have not been common on the New York subway up till now. We'll have to see what happens in the future.
There have been a number of reforms that have been proposed. The most basic one is just, hey, let's add a whole bunch of new justices. There have been some other proposals like making judicial appointments 18-year terms and just having a new one appointed every 2 years. What are your thoughts about those?
I think any kinds of proposals are probably appropriate to consider because any of those proposals would depend on the decision-making of people who are politically accountable. One thing about the decision, even critics of Roe might say, is, well, the justices were not politically accountable for making that decision. It's equally true the justices in Dobbs are not politically accountable. But any reform, even one might say any kind of extreme reform, like expanding the size of the court, which has been done in the past, that's all political. And it's made by political actors who then have to be accountable for their decisions. So to the extent we the people is something we take seriously and we recognize as we the people being the most fundamental power and authority under the Constitution, then we the people will be making those decisions. And as such, they won't be extreme. They'll be ultimately political decisions for which the people who made those decisions are going to be accountable politically. Right now, we can't hold any of the justices accountable politically, whether we agree with them or not. That's the whole point of being a justice. You're immune to political reprisals. But at least the reforms will not be immune to political reprisals.
Speaking again with Michael Gearhart, and I've got to start wrapping up, but I've got a question that you've already kind of touched on, which is that people who are upset by this decision, I see a lot of this on social media, and I'm sure you've seen it too, are angry at the Supreme Court. A lot of them are also angry at the Constitution. Why are we bound by this 200-year-old document? Why do we care what these dead white men have to say? Thomas Jefferson would be super proud. But I've been arguing, and I've said on the air, that first of all, this is bad strategy. Americans like the Constitution, and they embrace it, and it's better politics to make it yours than to give it over to the other side. And also that it's just not correct. The Constitution is a progressive and forward-thinking document written by deeply flawed people, but people who were forward-thinking themselves. And if the Supreme Court comes down with a decision that's against that, it's not the Constitution, it's the Supreme Court. That's me talking, though. What are your thoughts? If the Supreme Court issues a decision that people are upset by, is it the Constitution that we should be taking it out on, or is it the court?
Well, I think the first thing, the law professor, you know, the person that's devoted his life to the rule of law and to studying the Constitution, the first thought I have is robust discussions about this are good. Mm-hmm. That fosters, hopefully, better understanding, and such discussions are, of course, protected by the First Amendment. My second thought is, and I really want to emphasize this, is that as not just a law professor, but a person whose job is to sort of educate people about the Constitution, I fundamentally believe in the legitimacy of the U.S. Constitution. It's not a perfect document, but it has broad language. And ultimately, what we're really challenged to do is to think about how we should interpret it. And that's the critical question. it's not really whether or not the Constitution protects what we call unenumerated rights, rights that are not specifically mentioned as such. Of course it does, the most obvious being the right to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a right that many people of different political persuasions would recognize as a fundamental right. Well, if they do, that's not specified in the Constitution, and the Constitution provides its protection. So what we're really left with is the very thing that we teach in law school, the very thing that judges and justices should be concerned about and should be engaged in, and that is to how best to explain and justify their constructions of the Constitution. It's all about how we construe the Constitution. And the more that can be grounded in legitimate sources of decision, the more that can be grounded in persuasive reasoning, the better off the Supreme Court will be.
We have to wrap up. Final thoughts?
Well, this is just the beginning, of course,
mm-hmm.
Of a newer age, let's say, of constitutional decision-making. And I think that perhaps one thing that may be a great byproduct of all this is for people to become more politically engaged. I think if there's a cost that Roe had, it made people, some people complacent. And complacency has no role in a democracy. So I think the extent to which people are not happy or happy, they should become politically engaged and vote their preferences and then stick by those votes and vote again. That's the best way for people to be satisfied with how, not just the court, but with how people in Washington do their jobs.
Professor Michael Gearhart, UNC School of Law, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.